This table here?
Yes.
Yeah, that's fine. Major issues list.
On the first one, I really think that what you've done is good as far as making it a marketable product, but I think it ought to include economic or economic benefit. Because if you have something that you install that saves you so much money that it pays for itself in 2 years or some small increment of time, I don't see where you're meeting the spirit of any law to give a tax incentive for something somebody does for economic reasons. And I think if you add, you need to include or economic benefit.
Mike Massey, I'd respond by saying there's really no basis in the statute to ever discount a use determination based on an operator's ability to reduce operating costs associated with these conditions of control equipment. I don't believe it's appropriate for economic benefit to be factored in because the statute just doesn't support that interpretation, in my opinion. I don't have anything specific in mind, but I don't believe that reducing operating costs associated with pollution control equipment, which is what, you know, trying to derive that economic benefit out of something would do,
But then your reason for doing it is not to prevent pollution. Your reason for doing it was economic.
Well, my first response is, I think it's dangerous for this committee or this commission to ever speculate about what the reason somebody did something was. Statute provides that equipment that controls pollution is eligible for exemption. Our intentions, which leads to endless speculation, are constitutional for basis. But rather than debate that, I'd say this, that I think the commission at this point should explain to us kind of what they're doing. And, you know, I'm okay with you making that proposal. I'll just say that I think a lot of the issues that have been encountered problematic in this program are because there's a lot of speculation about what the intention for installing the equipment was. Yeah, I think statutory right to dispute if you think something did not have a pollution control benefit. Okay. But I do not think the statute supports an interpretation that somebody who installs a piece of equipment for pollution control also has figured out a way to run it in a less costly way or have a lower operating cost because they recycle a byproduct, et cetera. So I think it is a big policy issue, but I would oppose the idea of inserting a non-statutory criteria like economic benefit process.
I'm Bennett Samlin. I want to say that I think the point of the Prop 2 statute is that you, as a very initial matter, you have to look at the intent of the equipment, because it's not whether it's pollution control equipment. It's whether it's pollution control equipment designed to satisfy an EPA or other environmental regulation. So right in the very beginning, you have to decide the intent for installing that. So I don't think it's completely accurate to say intent is irrelevant.
Constitutional provision would not authorize the legislature to pass an exemption that did not look to the purpose for the installation of the equipment.
I will definitely concede that the initial purpose, initial extent, I should be real clear about my commentary. When people install equipment, the purpose of that installation is definitely relevant. Okay, so to the extent that you mean to say that the initial installation, the decisions about initial installation, you know, intent comes into play, I'd recognize that. But what I'm getting at is I'm not hearing that it's the initial intent. I'm hearing across the board, and after the fact, some economic benefit is starting to be derived from operating the equipment, that somehow starts to curtail qualification.
I don't mean to suggest something that somebody finds after the fact saves them money, that they should lose their tax exemption. My point is if you know going in that it's going to save you all this money, it's not the intent to save, you're not promoting less pollution, you're producing an economic benefit. I just don't, you know, if you brought that up before the voters in Texas, you would never say, if you explain, somebody's going to get all their money back in 2 years, plus you're going to give them a tax exemption. But it never voted for that proposition.
I think it might be helpful to, for those of you, some of you may have seen it, I'm sure the TCEQ staff has it. August 1st, 2007, from the author of HB 3732, Representative Hardcastle. And I won't read much of it, but he says, this gets to the intent. I did not intend, nor do I support an interpretation of anything in HB 3732 to prevent electric generating facilities from receiving exemptions for equipment simply because they also derive profit from a given piece of equipment or process. If it reduces pollution, it qualifies. And further down, I'm still quoting, I understand that the TCEQ's initial plan is to assume 100% exemption unless documentation establishes a legitimate basis for a lesser percentage. Yeah. I support that approach because, again, the goal of the legislation is to reduce pollution. Now, none of that was my opinion. I just want to get that out on the table.
Okay. It's one legislator's opinion whose legislature is acting on the clarified sense, and the AG has disagreed with, and in a written opinion. I mean, we can come up with lots of opinions. We can get 150 different opinions on that, and they all have the same weight. I mean, that's,
and I think one of the great things about this committee, Mike Massey, is that there's diversity of opinion about this. I think there's probably going to be some situations like Wayne has raised where reasonable minds will agree about whether something should be eligible or not. And I think we're never going to all agree about everything. But just on behalf of the people I represent, I think we should. We welcome the opportunity to take things up. I think looking at the ECL one by one, looking at a set of facts, you know, is a healthy way to do that. There's probably not going to be many broad categories of agreement, but we might be able to give the commission some assistance on calling up certain things and agreeing or not. So, you know, I think we're going to have to agree to disagree about maybe the way we strictly interpret the statute, and maybe just defer to, let's take things up one at a time and try to figure them out.
Okay.
Well, we're dealing with this issue on a major issues list. Is that what we're trying to?
Mm-hmm. I guess on the number one on that, Max, you're talking about the formula for tier three, correct?
Yes, sir. Tim Murray.
You're saying you can apply that formula to any other non tier one applications?
It would be any partial, any non-tier one or tier two.
Tier two, tier three, tier four.
It would be a tier three or tier four. Tier two, you think it's 100%, we wouldn't be applying the cap. We would just need some justification for why you believed it to be 100%.
John Nichols, but we are also saying that we're looking at tier one equipment that has hard-cut and partial exemptions as part of whether we want to throw that back into the mix.
Right, and that's what Miner touched on, that historically some of these partials had been included in the original equipment and categories list, and you know, throughout time, whatever original justification there may have been, we don't really have it firmed up as to how did we get to 20% here. So we think it would be better that at this time, if we're going to have a procedure and an equation in place to determine a partial percentage, to why not have them in each instance come through and use that procedure in order to justify the partial that they would receive.
So the equal and uniform that you're talking about is not necessarily equal to that format on any application, not a standard procedure for a certain category.
Right, we wouldn't try and run tier ones through the CAP procedure. We wouldn't try and run tier twos through the CAP procedure. But when there was a partial, when we believed that there was both pollution control benefits and production benefits, then regardless of tier three, tier four, we would apply the CAP in those situations.
In all situations.
Right, in all situations.
To clarify, what you're saying really then is that there won't be any partial exemption items on the predetermined list for tier one application?
No, sir. They would be 100% pollution control item.
Right. And is that to be pulled out into
yes, sir.
Every application?
You would have to come in for a tier three or for, to apply the CAP.
Cyrus, I'm sorry, you were first.
Leo Shearer. My concern about the partial percentage is that depending on how the numbers and the data looks, you can have something that's giving you a significant pollution control benefit and drive the exemption down to nothing, I think, or very, very, very small. And to me, if you're making a profit on the equipment, that's a good thing. You know, I think it's good for business and it's good for pollution control both. I think even if you're recovering materially, there needs to be a pollution control percentage that's exemptable. And my concern is that is that automatic day of calculation of making it's not pollution control when it is. So
two questions. First question would be, would an applicant still be able to use, they would have to use this CAP, or could they still propose a different way to come up with the partial calculation, say in this case, where they say, well.
If y'all adopted that, is that's going to be your calculation for that?
For everything,
or that list, for anything you receive.
Because I wonder, in the statute, doesn't it still say that an applicant can offer their own?
For a tier four piece of equipment, an applicant can still offer their own calculation.
For tier four.
However, what we've been directed to do, very specifically by 3206 and 3544, is to be uniform.
Right.
To use the treatment of those tier four applications with how we normally process partial applications.
You've been told to use the CAP.
Well, not by passing, not that terminology. You're supposed to apply uniformity. And I would offer to go to the heart of how to fix this problem is if, you know, traditionally tier, the table has been used to expedite agency decision making on things that everybody agrees to. It's an efficiency mechanism for the agency and for the taxpayers and taxpayers. If what you're planning to do to harmonize the two statutes that you could interpret to be in conflict, uniformity, they can use their own. I think it's fair to say that those two statutes need to be harmonized by the statute agency. Maybe what this leads to is you at least got to go through a process of whether tier four items could be calculated and put on the Part A table. Some of them are already there, okay? But I think it might be a bad decision for everyone, commissions especially, to make a kind of across-the-board conclusion that you're not going to have partial use determinations in tier one, because how are you going to comply with the procedural requirements of tier four? Okay, applying the CAP without maybe having the benefit of having gone through ahead of time, using this committee as a sounding board, putting some things on the table, Part A. I mean, you would be, as an agency, I think, well served to try to place some things on Part A if reasonable minds could agree that they should be there on a partial percentage. It will make your job under Tier 4 easier, if you get what I'm saying.
Wayne Frizzell, and we actually had another committee once before, and we looked at the tier four stuff, and nobody could come to an agreement of any of it being any set percentages.
Greg Maxson, as what I said earlier was that it would be something the staff would adopt to say that in order to be equal and uniform, they would apply a calculation or a formula across the board.
But I just want to point out that that was heavily discussed before, and there was a lot of trouble trying to come to any conclusion. And not that it couldn't be done now, sure. But I just wanted the history there.
No, and I, like Matt said, I agree. When I was in some of those discussions, and it will not be easy to get reasonable minds to agree about the whole list, but there may be some. And I would just direct the commission to, before you relinquish the benefits of having partials on Part A at the table, think about you're basically going to stick a whole lot of applications that would have been coming under Tier 4 in an expedited way into the CAP process without recognizing this idea that those applicants could use their own term methodology.
Do you mind if I'd like to clarify one thing, just so direct your discussion. I believe it's our rules that allow for individual calculations to be submitted. That's not in statute.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was the implementation of the statute that directed you to implement procedures as to relate to this.
It was through our rule.
And I'm not sure, and I don't want to interject too much on the committee's discussion here, but it's something that I think speaks to the concern that Mr. Nassy's raised. An example of what he's talking about, I think, would be flue gas recirculation components. It's on Part B. It's also on Part A. It's on Part A at 100%. If you have an item that's on Part A at 100%, obviously the agency wouldn't make you go through the exercise of trying to come to some sort of partial determination or run it through the CAP there. So in those instances, like I said, we got a list of 18 pieces of equipment. We were required to put that list in our rules, so that list is there. But it's not our hope to complicate the process in any way.
So effectively, then you just put 100% in Tier B on that.
Tier 1 on that. Yes.
Yeah, and that's good to know going in, because I think what we'll do as part of this process is look at Tier 4 and are there items that really should be on Part A, Part of this. And I'm just suggesting that I don't know that we should be walking away from 100% or partial use determinations being on Part A, because some of those items we might agree are across the board 50%ers, for example.
My second question, was on this idea of modifying the CAP equation by revising the definition of capital cost old. Can you just explain that a little more, what that actually means? So, because traditionally what we've done, right, we've said you have a new type of process that leads to more NOx reductions. And if you had done it this way with the traditional pollution control, it would have cost you this much, and you're doing it this new way, which is actually more efficient, it's costing you this much, and you compare the two, isn't that?
I'd actually like to let, if I can call on Mr. Thomas.
I guess my question is, what is the modification that
it's not very plain here.
Yeah, I don't know what the modification is that's being proposed in terms of capital cost.
And I'm not sure I can explain it much better than what's there on paper, so at some point Minor or Joe wants to jump in and save me. But the way that I've understood it is it's been very difficult to apply the CAP in situations where you're not replacing an older piece of equipment. So where it's a situation where we've got a new or novel piece of equipment going in for the first time, and we're having trouble finding a comparable piece of equipment without the pollution control feature. So that's what this...
Are you going to say, what are you trying to do, say alternate capital costs instead of old? I mean, I don't understand what you say revise, but you don't have a suggestion there as well.
Right, and again, if that's something we want to table for now and want to wait until the next meeting and we can put a definition in front of you,
yeah, we need to see what informed actually is hard to react.
Yeah.
And I might be saying same thing, this one up there also, but if there's not a capital cost owed, if there's not a piece of equipment that's already there, then the equation loses its meaning and really.
So you want
difficult for us to deal with in that situation.
So what you want is a replacement that allows you to use the equation. Is that correct?
I was the opposite way. Right now, what the capital cost owes is limited to the cost of comparable equipment. In some cases, equipment's being replaced, so we'd want to be able to use that amount of money in terms of the capital cost owed. We'd want the capital cost of the equipment that's being replaced to be able to be used in that calculation.
Oh, because either...
So, in other words, you're saying if you're replacing a piece of equipment, you want like the old type of equipment at a modern day price.
Yes.
So you want to look back
at staff. Okay.
This is Don. I'm not sure. I may be off base here, but are you trying to address a situation where someone brings in some equipment, it's a partial use determination, they replace an old way of doing it, sat there with an exemption, and now they're replacing the equipment again, they're updating the equipment? What situation? I'm not following the situation.
He's got two situations. He's got one where he's got an old piece of equipment and he's going to replace it with a new, less polluting piece of equipment. But because the equipment is old and it was bought with old dollars,
mm-hmm.
he needs a new equivalent cost to do the actual comparison because, you know, buying something 30 years ago is not the same as buying it today. So, right?
So he's looking for a reproduction cost need, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Not a replacement, a reproduction cost.
A reproduction or alternate cost. And he just needs a verbiage there to. And he also has the occasion where it's a brand new facility, and if you're doing a partial calculation, you got to compare what you would have built with what you're planning to build. And you can't call this other one old because it doesn't exist.
Right. The example that came before us before was if you have a combined cycle natural gas unit that has low emissions, you're using the combined cycle process to get low emissions versus doing a single cycle gas plant where you have to add a bunch of NOx controls onto it. So you have to compare those two.
Right.
Right? Isn't that? Because you're using a totally different process which might not actually have the type of pollution control equipment you would have on a single
cycle. But I can think of lots of other.
Yeah, there's lots of
examples.
And they just want flexibility. So if it's
it doesn't make sense to call it old because it's not always old equipment.
Right.
It's the
alternative approach.
Alternative scenario equipment.
The polluting option.
And so you just want a verbiage to change that.
The dirty option.
We were, from talking to staff, trying to address a simple.
So that's a simple problem. I'll write some recommendations.
Sometimes it helps me. Maybe I'm a little slow with this, but sometimes it helps me to see a calculation numbers with the current rule, and then one with what you're trying to revise it to.
And that's part of the tier three equation. And if you ever go through the tier three equation, that's what he's addressing, as it's called old equipment because they were
original investment and your new investment. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to benchmark against the two to see how that shakes out. Part of
the and similarly, on the first issue, you're just trying to update get away from the terminology byproduct, because sometimes it's more than a byproduct.
Here's that. Generally, we are trying to determine how to comply with House Bill 3206 and House Bill 3544 specifically. That requires that the standards and methods for making a determination that are established in the rules apply uniformly to all applications or determinations, including Tier 4 applications. That's basically a summarize. That's not exactly. So that's what we're trying to do. To come up with a uniform way to address, what to address 3206.
And isn't the way to do that is to look at anything that comes in under Tier 4 and apply either the Tier 1, Tier 2, or Tier 3 process to it, whichever is appropriate?
And that's the reason for our at least initial thoughts of defining marketable product.
Okay, run us through why that's necessary why is it necessary to make the change to marketable product from byproduct in order to use your long-standing processes that you've had for a decade to judge all applications that come in, whether
they're sometimes Tier 4 or not? Sometimes it's more of the same product instead of a byproduct.
Byproduct is a very specific definition.
Okay. So what does the existence of an expedited processing list in Tier 4
conflict
create a conflict? What's the conflict that you're solving there?
He's solving a calculation problem, not the Tier 4 problem.
It sounds to me like maybe it's a problem that exists whether 3544 and the bills exist or not. I'm not following how the bills have created this issue.
The bill, it was a problem. The bills have forced them to address it.
To ensure consistency.
Yes.
Okay.
Any further discussion on item 1?
Okay, we'll obviously continue to discuss that.
Yeah, I mean, Mac, nicely, my comment about all this whole debate is 3732 had an intent, whatever you want to interpret it as, it required the agency to expedite processing of those applications, so we have to be mindful how we can help the commission do that consistent with the clear purpose of that statute. So before we walk away from options about how to deal with Part A, we should consider that process as a way to do that. Already fixed things that are on both Part A and Part B of the list, but there's probably a few items on Part B of the list that warrant consideration on Part A of the list that aren't there.
Is it Greg Maxim, is it fair to say if it's on Part B of the list and it's on Part A of the list at 100%, then we can just say that anything on Part B that's on Part A at 100%, why don't we just put 100% on Part B and get rid of those as a question of variable?
It's duplicate, and we'd love to take something off of Part B of the list. It's just we feel hamstrung as far as what the legislation said. You shall have 18 items of pollution control property listed.
Well, I mean, we could list it on there, and if it's already on Part A, then on Part B, we just put 100%.
Replace the B.
That I have no problem with that.
Yeah, and that's all I'm getting at here, Mike Nassy, suggesting that we look at those Bs and maybe there's things we all agree. Well, first of all, there's already things that are 100, mm-hmm. So we can replace the B with 100 and go through the rest of that list and see if there's other Bs we can replace with numbers, because you can consistently apply your methodologies ahead of time. I mean, you don't have to wait for a case-by-case submission.
Do we need to do that? Do we need to go through and do that, or can y'all look at the duplicates and say what our recommendation would be that we're...
Do you want to do that? Start that process now?
think about it, then next meeting we have, then let the staff come back to us and say, this is, we think a duplicate's a book, therefore Part B.
And then we can vote up or down.
That's fine, yeah, I don't think staff has any problem addressing
duplicates.
Well, we have experience with some of the things on that list, and we can do that one too. So some of the things we might not have that experience with, and we could use your advice.
Okay. All right, we're ready to move to the next item. Any other discussions on the first one? I have the equipment categories list. I'll just open that for discussion.
Cyrus Reed, Lone Star. So there, I counted 7 items that have partial percentages. And is it the commission staff's intention now to remove all of those 7 items?
Yeah, again, that was the thought, to have Part A of the ECL standalone as 100% predetermined, scientifically justifiable, agreed upon by everyone for expedited processing, as Tier 1, 100% positive use determinations. Tier 2, again, I've always seen Tier 2 applications as it's something you think should be on Tier 1, but isn't for whatever reason. So you're currently applying under Tier 2, and then after receiving a certain threshold of Tier 2 applications for which 100% use determinations were granted, would be added to Tier 1. And then Tier 3 being anything which would have both a pollution control benefit and a production benefit.
The dry cleaning numbers on here, because 5 of the 7 have to do with dry cleaning, so there wasn't you didn't feel like there was a real justification for coming up with those numbers?
At this point in time, there's at least in my looking at it and going back as to how this was created, I didn't see a solid scientific justification.
What's the difference in cost for going through a Tier 1 application versus, I can't believe I'm representing the dry cleaner industry right now. Tier 1 versus a Tier 3.
Tier 1 versus Tier 3?
Yeah, in terms
it's
of
substantial. It's $150 for a Tier 1 and I believe $2,500 for a Tier 3.
Or Tier 3.
I just can see a lot of little dry cleaning facilities that wouldn't want to pay.
Let me ask the reverse of that. If you have numerous Tier 3s that you see consistently, and it's the same stuff, but it's always in a Tier 3 application, and you get the same ruling every time you do that Tier 3 application, why would you not move that to a Tier 1?
Yeah. Again, I think that's what Mr. Nassy was touching on, and I think if we did have a situation where every time we see this same equipment thing come in as a partial, it's always calculated out regardless of the facility or where it's used in the process as 60%, then it would need to come over to Part A of the ECM.
I agree with that. I mean, it seems basically supportive of the charge here to get as much on the Part A as we can. If it's partial exemptions, but we know with a degree of certainty what those percentages are, then it streamlines the process, clarifies things, and makes it more uniform.
I'm assuming there's less stuff that goes to the commission of Tier 1. I mean, when you say streamlined, it's pretty much accepted.
So it seems to me contra. Maybe staff needs to go back to it and look at these Tier 1 items that are partial exempt and come up with some supportive documentation as to, you know, to support the percentages or modify them as needed.
And if y'all don't feel that it's current, because what was done when they, like on the dry cleaning, 1994, how they do it now, I know the rules and regs have changed, and stuff that was done may not be current. And if there is, if things have changed to where that number is not supported in today's, then we can remove it.
Right. And yeah, as I said before, in order to take something off this list, you have to have a reason justification. So we'll look back at it at the staff, and I think we originally identified these items because we don't have a reason justification currently for it being on there. So we'll take a look at these pieces of equipment themselves and come back to you.
Just so you're aware, and we'll do that, and we can have a broader discussion next time, but for the dry cleaning equipment, I believe the discussions that we had, we don't really get any applications for those, for that equipment at all. So while we did discuss the concerns of small business and increase in fees, we're just not seeing those applications. So that's why, that's...
Okay.
Yeah, and Mike Massey, the commission was already doing a good job of reviewing this, and I think 3732, when it codified some of existing practice, which is to maintain the list, right? And it also provided for a three-year review. And that's what this is all about. We're trying to vet the list every 3 years to make sure it stays current. And that's kind of what my comment is. Before we walk away from that tool of doing partials, as long as we're revisiting it every 3 years, we should be able to take care of that concern, which we're required to do by statute.
Any other discussion on ECLs?
I've had a long-standing objection to M15 and M16, but I don't want to get into discussion now. What I'd really prefer to do, I've written up my opinion about this several times, and what I prefer to do is just go ahead and send it in and have it distributed to all of y'all to read all the reasons I don't like that.
Can you send an email to Bob?
Well, you're going to distribute information like that, aren't you?
It's either way. I can hold them, you know, well, I can put a mailing list together.
Well, just one of you tell me who's doing it, and I'll send it to them.
Yeah, I'll get you mine at the very end when we adjourn. I'll get my contact information to you, and you can run it through me for the time being.
I actually printed up the attendance list. I was going to hand that to you guys, but if y'all want it now, go ahead and do it. Because everybody's emails that's here in this room today, and obviously you know who's on the committee, so their email is on there.
And we can send things.
I didn't sign in.
Are we going to send things to staff or send things through?
That's why I asked y'all to sign in.
I signed in down there and got this.
So other than Bob and Derry, Bob's trying to pass out his cards.
I'm on the website.
Somebody needs to get ball rolling, typing all those emails into one. Their list.
So this is just kind of to expedite y'all's communication. We hope to have all this up on the web by Monday. There's little processes we have to go to get all this stuff posted on the web. So just kind of expedite y'all's communication now. But we hope to have it all up there available by Monday.
All right.
Bob, you're the only one missing from this.
Yeah, I apologize. I was distracted when I came in.
You said tell us your email, and we can just close that.
Sure. List. It's easy. bob.adair@conifersettles.com.
Phillips is 1 hour or 2 hours?
Two hours.
Mr. John, I have a question. Wayne, what did you ask? Did you ask for consideration for approval of M16?
Or certainly not 100%. I mean, that.
Did you have a calculation?
Zero
for part.
Okay, still.
No, but let me, like I said, let me just send all my. Cool. I protested this and everything else.
Right.
And
this is stuff they have to do in order to do their business, right?
Yeah, and they've been doing it for over 100 years.
Right. It's part of the productive process.
Right.
You can't produce your good or service without it.
You can, but it'd be prohibitively expensive. Well, a part of it's prohibitively expensive, and part of it should get a partial because it's largely safety related. So,
I guess on the second one, does spill and response equipment, is that destructive or non-destructive?
Well, the, my whole thing there is blowout preventer in that, again, that's been put on there for 80 years, and it's largely a safety issue, not a pollution issue, although it does both. But it shouldn't be getting 100% when it's so much of a safety issue.
Well, I would suggest without us spending a lot of time on this.
Yeah, that's why I said I wanted to email out mine.
Yeah, and without us spending a lot of time on this, I would be curious to how many applications we actually get on this. I suspect not very many.
Lots of them.
A lot of them, okay.
Every drilling rig, when it moves to a new county, has to apply again.
Okay. But do they actually apply?
Yes.
Okay.
Do they just apply to the county where they move since they've already got it used?
No. If it changes counties, it's changed situs, and you have to have a new application for the county.
A new application for exemption.
Yes.
The determination stays the same.
Yeah.
It's one use determination.
A fees assessed and application is processed just like it was originally.
Okay.
I mean, if you're going to do it at all, it ought to be on the list, but it shouldn't be 100%. I mean, it just...
Why do we have one that is 100? Anyone know?
Yes, because it's similar to what a people add for water reclamation to make sure they're not dumping stuff that's polluted. But in this case, it's to recycle the mud that you put back down the hole so you don't have to get tank after tank after tank of new mud.
Did the commissioners rule on this?
Yes, they did. Well, yes, they did, but if you listen to the comments, they felt that their hands were tied because of the list. But they were actually...
So they didn't rule on the substance of the issue?
No, they ruled on it's a legal technicality, so we have to rule this way, but they expressed an opinion, or at least that's what I got, that they wish they could have ruled another way.
Well, I got that. Hear someone, I mean, what we have now is some equipment that we're told has been used for 100 years and that is necessary for safety and for production of the
drilling process.
Do their process. I'd like for someone to bring some evidence contrary to that, or else we ought to remove it.
Let's not bog our
time.
Just Greg Maxim, on this time, as far as if they've been doing it 100 years, it's not that. It's, you know, the catalytic converter was made in 1992 and it's doing something, and you have one made in 1995, you get the exemption, whereas the one before doesn't get it, even though they do the same thing. But I agree with you on the other note. If they've been doing it 100 years and throwing that out, if it's truly something that's pollution control or safety or whatever, then that's something we need.
I think the length of time doing it informs us on the other, right? Informs us on the other to a degree. The Constitution requires that it be installed for a regulatory reason, right?
Yes.
Meet some sort of regulatory obligation, right? So it just informs us on the other, that it's something being used for productive purposes.
Yes. Yeah. But well, please, let's not bog down this. Yeah. Let me send you my written...
No, I just want to get it teed up for the next time. I think we need to give time for someone is hearing this to come back and say, oh, no, wait, you don't have all the information.
Well, I'll just say I represent oil and gas, so, and I'm not prepared to address this today. I'll check into it.
I want time for everyone to go look and see if there is a...
Okay.
If there is a general analysis.
Fair enough. Any other comments on the ECL? All right, we'll go to the next item. Personal use determinations. Any discussion?
Which is again, I think that was somewhat wrapped up in the conversation we had before with the different definitions. We're just looking for a way to modify the current cap procedure to cover all partials.
All right. I should ask any other discussion on this one.
Yeah.
Okay.
It looks like a repeat to me. So.
Okay. This is Don. I'm going to engage in a short part of the discussion just to lay something out, because I know I demonstrated and continue to have some confusion about what exactly we're trying to do.
The legislature in this last session said, hey, we want to clarify that we did not try to expand the what property should be exempt when we acted in 07. And we want you to, we want to set, so we, they try to say right here, or in 3544 in those bills, that we want you to be consistent, to maintain the same consistency you always had, that we didn't create some list that's anything, where you make it up as you go along. We didn't do that. If the proposals here are to find consistency with that tier four by bringing more flexibility and more unpredictability to the previous determinations, well, then I want to discuss that at some length. If I need to, I'd like to sometime, we can do this some other time, right? Someone can explain, just help me understand better how we're bringing consistency to the tier four category. Same consistency and standards that have always been used on tiers one, two, and three. That's, I don't understand how we're doing that yet on that. And that's probably my failing. So I'm inviting, I'm trying here to invite that, if not at this moment.
Okay. Thank you. By the way, I don't know how quickly, and I don't want to prolong this meeting, or just want to make a point that we do have this meeting in this room all day. So if it's the will of the group, we can break for lunch, or we can continue, whatever the pleasure of the committee is.
What more do we have to do?
I thought you guys have environmental benefit at the site wrapped up in like 20 minutes.
Yeah. What's your pleasure?
And we're already at partial use determination. We're going to back up and go back through the ECL individually? Or what's?
Well, did you have any comments about it?
No, I think we're
it?
Waiting on...
We're going to go back and readdress it for the next meeting.
At the next meeting, but not at this one.
Right.
Yeah, I'd
say we're continue on. We don't have much left.
Okay. Yeah, we don't have, yeah.
I'd say continue on.
Just thought I'd make some
questions. Okay. Chair. Is it your understanding of our agenda that the only thing left to discuss is the use of benefit at the site? Discussion.
Unless the committee wants to add something, and we can certainly take a motion to add that to the agenda.
The only other agenda item that I was thinking is you wanted to ask for public comment.
True.
No one has indicated on this list that they want to address the committee. Right? Or?
Did they have the opportunity today?
They may have heard some discussion here and decided that
right,
change
that's
the
true.
Tim, do you have any,
should,
like that,
should,
do you have any cards?
I didn't bring any, but I can get
no cards.
Oh, cards for the
signature. Public comment.
Yeah, they're back there on that table.
Yeah.
No, has anybody submitted any to you?
No.
Okay.
No.
No. And if
just
if someone was moved to speak, I think it would be within the presiding officer's discretion. If at the end he wanted to offer them the opportunity, I don't, before adjourning, I don't think anybody would have a problem with that.
Okay. And I guess we can move on to the next item. Benefit at the site requirement. Discussion.
And just what I've distributed, what we've distributed to you was a copy of the Texas Register. This was the last time the rules were amended. There were, what's been tapped for you were specific comments and responses that were made on the benefit of the site requirement. I also went back and looked at the 2002 Texas Register when it was originally introduced, but the responses to comment in that instance were silent, so there wasn't much value added to providing that to you guys. But this was just provided for background information, just so you guys know where we've been and what we've put out there, what we've said. I'm sure this is an issue that's familiar to everybody in this room.
And I'm aware that the commission has also issued briefs on this issue, and I don't know about public, I guess it is public information.
Well, I know
that on the specific company, I know that.
Right. The commission at the, what was it, January
13th
agenda specifically expressed their desire to have this committee and to have the agency as a whole provide more guidance to the regulated community as to the interpretation of the environmental benefit at the site requirement.
Bob Adair, I certainly don't expect us to decide this today, but it is informative. I would encourage you to get a copy of the transcript of the January 13th hearing, if you can read to get the insight from the commissioners.
Does anybody have a copy of the signed order?
I don't think I have
one. The signed order for what?
On the appeal.
On the appeal, the Valero?
Okay. It's the language in which they made the motion.
Is there anyone that could express verbally what that signed order said in a nutshell?
I'm not 100% sure that the signed order spoke directly to environmental. I think the way that it was left is this equipment may provide an environmental benefit at the site, and we ask the executive director to issue new use determinations, which, as we understood, were to be consistent with the guidance provided from the dais at that commission meeting. So, again, going back and looking at the transcript, or I believe it's still posted on the website, you should still be able to view that agenda item. And that's where they were asking for specific guidance on to what can we do for the regulated community to shore up and show what our interpretation of environmental benefit at the site has been and needs to be.
As you can imagine, I am getting a lot of comments on this, and I'll share more as we get more, but I am committed to listen to all sides on this issue.
So, someone give us a side on it.
Keeping the current language, the rule language, means essentially keeping the provision that you must show an environmental benefit at the site. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I think what staff would like to do, and probably what the commissioners would like to see, would be additional rule language or additional language in the form of guidance as to meeting that at the site requirement, rather than removing it or anything like okay. that.
Was there
it's just additional definition?
Additional definition.
Is there what's the gray area there that needs to be?
I believe the way that it's been interpreted by staff is that environmental benefit at the site should be occurring within the fence line at the site. It was our understanding that was in keeping with, you know, the rule that exemptions from taxation were supposed to be strictly construed in favor of the not granting the exemption. But there's been some questions raised as to, also it was something that we thought needed to be done as far as the uniformity among different types of applications and different pieces of equipment. But there's been questions raised by the regulated community and by the commissioners themselves as to whether or not that is a correct interpretation.
The question before the commission, if I remember correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, was the environmental benefit was the production of a less polluting fuel that we have no idea where it's being sold to. Could be sold to the state of Washington or Alaska or Washington, D.C. or anywhere else. And if the environmental benefit from that, producing that fuel, could be anywhere. Is someone understand this different than me?
What was I mean, I'm not sure what you're talking about. Was there like a permit requirement that had to be met for whatever this piece of equipment is at the site or not at the site? Or
This is a hydro treater at a refinery, and their claim is it, since it makes a cleaner burning fuel, then it ought to get an exemption.
The whole plant ought to get out.
The whole HRSG should.
The hydro treater should. No, the federal feds require change the requirements for fuel formulation so that fuel burns cleaner. So the market for fuel in the United States was changed, where it has to meet a certain standard. And hydrotreaters were installed in order to make that plant meet that standard. Is that?
Yes.
And so, so they are, the environmental benefit, if you look at the environmental benefit issue, but my only question here is that the commission's saying, well, let's give them more direction. Is there someone making an argument that there's environmental benefit at the site on that case?
There was, there were briefs offered in that case, and without getting without getting into every detail of the merits of that particular appeal, I think the general question has been raised that we've interpreted environmental benefit at the site to be within the fence line of the site. There are alternative interpretations that believe that definition should be expanded to the area of the site, or a pollution control benefit that is created at the site wherever it may be realized. So I think that's the broader programmatic question that this committee has been asked to weigh in on, is what does environmental benefit at the site mean?
Well, it was a definition of defining the extent of the site.
Yes.
That could be one thing, like I said, that could be one additional definition you could be offering, what the site is.
We're talking about moving the fence line? Basically,
well, you could either
out from the fence line.
You could say it's the fence line. You could say it's the county.
Adjacent to the fence line, in the county, within a mile, continental United States, within the universe.
Well, actually, I'm sorry, Mike. That's the second one that they wanted to ask. The fact that they,
as you said, as fence line, area of the site, or environmental benefit created at the site, wherever that environmental benefit is realized.
And just to be clear, my question was, I was thinking much more small-minded. Is it just a definition of, is it the permanent facility, the land owned? That's what I'm getting at. Is that the additional definition? Because if that's all we're looking at, we might be able to get to that pretty quick.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. I just don't think, it's helpful at all to the case.
Used.
Well, again,
in addition to where it's
produced.
Yeah. What is the Just to clarify some of the discussions that went on at the commission agenda, there was discussion on how benefit of the site is looked at from things like slurry walls and injection wells also. And so what is the environmental benefit associated with those types of activities and kind of compared to the activity that was specifically under consideration at the agenda meeting? So I just wanted to make it clear that, you know, there's a bigger right. discussion that went on at the agenda.
Right. Again, Bob Lane here, and I'm representing Texoda, not Valero. But I've read the transcript from January 13th. I've read Valero's briefs. I've read Jefferson County's briefs, public interest brief, TCQ's brief. I've tried to get a general, and I have not been any privy to a lot of discussions in the background on this, but it's my understanding that part of it is that at the site is only in the flowchart. It's not in the statutes. It's not in the regulations anywhere else. I think that's what they're alleging, that it's only in the flowchart. That they are also, and this is also relates to multiple refineries, not just one, and it's multiple refineries, and it's a downstream hydrotreater at the end of the process, not some hydrotreaters, not in the middle of the plant. Specifically, I think it's in the ultra-low sulfur diesel units.
One of them,
okay. I don't know, I didn't read enough if that relates to all of them, but it's those type of units, if that gives you an idea of what it is. I hesitate. Restating Valero's position because this is their position to state. But anyway, I would encourage you to read, all of you to read the transcript and the briefs if you can get a better handle on this. And I'm still fuzzy on it, even though I read all this. Mike Nasi had a good point. If it's fairly narrow, we might could get to it quicker. If it's, I think there were some comments, for example, that there are, for example, error prevention benefits people outside the fence line. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty obvious in the neighborhoods around it. So it's not specifically the fence line, if you want to draw it that narrow. So, but we have a lot to try to get our arms around this, and I don't pretend to have it right now.
How would you deal with something like E16, where if EPA does come down with a rule with best control available technology for carbon dioxide, where there's no environmental benefit at the site, but it's to prevent climate change globally? So I don't, that's a very special.
Well, that stops pollutants from coming out at a site.
That's true. So the benefit is you're having less.
It's still at the site.
Our interpretation of this has always been that it's really about, you're making the productive process cleaner. If you're putting the equipment in to make the productive process cleaner, that's what we want to be exempting. And if you're making products cleaner, it's a complete different thing, and you have a market that's taking care of that.
That's correct. A cleaner product that's mandated by the government doesn't deserve a tax break at all, because that's the only market that exists now for that cleaner product because of the environmental regulation. It's a totally different issue than protecting pollution at the production.
And we're talking about property tax. So it should be
a local issue.
Locally to that property.
And the value of that property.
Just the production on that property.
One thing that I remember all along as a kind of a guiding principle in this is that if you were a manufacturer of property that controlled pollution, you made scrubbers, for example, for industry, for application. You didn't get the exemption as a manufacturer.
You shouldn't, that's right.
Bought somebody's scrubber and you installed it in your plant,
you should get
that.
Right.
So
that's exactly right.
This is taking it kind of one step beyond. Yeah, that makes,
so the on site, off site one has always been
an
issue.
A bad test for it.
I've never thought it was a good test for what mattered in this, though I thought, well, it seems to be working, it seems to have worked, and it seems to have been an indicator of whether we're talking about environmental benefit in the productive process on that site.
Right. If what I've read on the site only came in 2001, is that right?
I think it was part of the 2002 adoption.
Okay.
Yeah, because the statute just says they have to show the anticipated environmental benefits from the installation of the facility, blah, 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 for the control of air, water, land pollution. It doesn't say on site.
Right. This has been at Salmon. I think that's a good point. I mean, we could live with an exemption if you created some pollutant on the site that was contained in a little canister and then it got moved somewhere else and caused pollution. I think the on-site is a bad test. I think the way Don phrased it is correct. Are we controlling pollution in the production process, wherever that may be, versus a product that controls pollution? And as John said, that has no business in Prop 2 at all.
That's in the Constitution.
Just a point of clarification, the term, as some of you know, the term on-site and off-site has different meanings for the common public versus those who work with plants a lot. It's really intended to mean on-site, so you guys correct me if I'm wrong, that's generally related to a particular unit. It doesn't mean just within the fence line. You can have off-site property that's within the manufacturing fence line, but it's considered off-site because it's off-site of that particular unit.
Mm-hmm. Probably.
So, I'm not trying to confuse matters, but...
Well, that's a more, how would you say that? Is that a more industry-specific definition?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Again, I get, maybe we're flogging a dead horse now, but I've always found the on-site thing to be a bit confusing to though it might be very useful. It seemed to have been useful. I've never had a problem with it being there because it seemed to be working for the agency as part of the process. But when I you say environmental benefit on site, kind of seems what you mean. We want them to not pollute that impacts anywhere. There's environmental regulation, you don't impact two counties over, and you have to do something.
If they have to treat
and install some equipment not to pollute two counties over, you ought to be exempt from that.
Yes.
I think that's kind of the more simplistic reading of that, but I think in practice, my observation has been that it's been kind of working here. And I thought it was being used more to tie things to pollution coming from the productive process versus.
Maybe another way to say it, I think what TCQ is rather than on site, I think what you're trying to say is you intend if there's an emissions reduction from the equipment at that plant, that's what you say is exempt. Which is a little distinction from it.
We're probably going to see that flow chart.
And Paul's an engineer. Feel free to jump in here.
I would find that a reasonable definition.
I was trying to get clarification from, I don't know if that's what TCQ has in.
I can give you just a little bit of background into what I think the at-the-site requirement was designed to do. Again, it's since it is people in the local taxing districts that are bearing the burden of the loss of revenue, there needed to be something in the rules to ensure that those people received the benefit of bearing that burden. So I think that's what the at-the-site requirement was originally intended to do.
Ben and Sam, the problem with that is that just to take like a hypothetical Valero case, you could have vehicles using that fuel back at the plant site, and then you're benefiting that county, but I don't think there should be any exemption for that situation. I think geography is a bad way of looking at it. I think it's productive pollution control versus end product pollution control. One's entitled to it, in my opinion, no matter where it is. I'm speaking for cities that are very localized. I think if you, like Don said, if you're preventing pollution three counties over, but not in your county, but it's because of the productive process, I don't have a problem with that exemption.
Well,
I think it needs to, but I do have a problem with people that characterize an end product as pollution control and then think that the productive capacity ought to be tax exempt. The only thing
I'd like to point out here, and I agree with you for the most part, but let's say a hydro treater has no emissions itself, let's take that one off the table. A piece of equipment has no emissions itself, but it prevents emissions from that plant. Okay.
So it replaces something that had emissions? Is that what you're
saying? Well, it reduces, or if you didn't have it, it you would have more emissions from the plant. You should get a benefit, even though the emissions aren't coming straight off that piece of equipment. It's lowering the emissions on the site. So
I'm okay with that.
Yes.
That's different, though, than building a product that itself.
I agree with you. I just didn't want to. I didn't want to get entirely away from the geographic thing because you want to prevent emissions from the site, and it should be included whether there's a vent off whatever that piece of equipment is or if the vent is somewhere else on the plant. So,
well, an example is on this list. Is one that always cracks me up is the chicken burners, the chicken incinerators. If you had a facility that was taking chicken carcasses and dumping it five counties away, and then you put it in an incinerator instead, you're not preventing chicken carcass pollution in that county. But I still don't have a problem with the exemption because you're fixing the pollution of the process, not the end product. You're not making cleaner chicken
legs. Mike Bassey, I'd like to go on the record and say incinerating dead chickens. Because I've smelled conflict. Just to kind of the spirit of the committee giving help to the commission, Ben and Don are right on in terms of the legal foundation of your way to deal with this issue derives from the amendment and the product concept. So if this committee were to spend productive time helping you all, I think it would really be better to talk about it in those terms than to talk about on and off-site. Because candidly, the on and off-site distinction really doesn't have a statutory basis, and the product thing does. So doesn't mean we'll all agree on what's a product, but I think it's a better area for us to be talking. This is a general observation.
Can you give us some background of why the on-site came about? I mean, I know it's in your briefs, but it might be good to air that correctly.
I believe it would be with that rulemaking committee that developed this chart here and some of the discussions that would have taken place there. And again, I've looked back through those documents and the meeting minutes from those are very, very general. So it's hard to pinpoint it without having been in the room. But again, I think it was something that was added in order to ensure, as I said before, that those people that are in that local taxing district do receive some benefit for giving up this lost revenue. Also, I think it's included in order to make sure that the environmental benefits claimed aren't sort of nebulous environmental benefits that would be common to people across the United States. And also, it was something where it allowed the TCEQ as part of it working for the agency, and that it's something that you can apply to a Tier 1, to a Tier 2, to a Tier 3, and you were able to apply that requirement uniformly to many different types of equipment.
So it was uniformity provision?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. John Nichols, can we address this perhaps by augmenting this definition with some terminology that reflect direct benefit versus indirect or tangential benefit?
Yeah, and again, I'm not the only lawyer in the room, but when you define one word, then you have to define words in the definition. So that could be some help. But
that's a great visceral attraction. The problem is, I instantly thought about Cyrus's example about what is the direct environmental benefit of reducing carbon.
And additionally, there was something in the legislative history with 1131, and it was something that was discussed on the dais. With the Valero appeal, is there was at one time you had to show a quantifiable environmental benefit, and that there was a decision by the legislature to not include quantifiable in the legislation. So, what is an environmental benefit? I think what we got from, at least what I took from the commission meeting, was you don't have to quantify it, you don't have to put a number on it, you don't have to net it, but you do have to show that it's a non-zero environmental benefit.
Yeah, because that's really my asking. If you look at the constitutional amendment and the statute, the terminology is you can't get the exemption solely on the basis that you produce the product that reduces the emission. So it's an exclusionary criteria only indirectly, not to sound too much like a lawyer. Just because you produce a product that has environmental benefit, you're not out of the game. It just, that can't be the sole basis.
If your productive process needs to have equipment to clean it up, if your productive process needs to be cleaned up and you're producing environmental stuff, you get an exemption on that property used in the productive, to clean the productive process. Yeah, you're not out of the game because of that. But you don't get an exemption for producing a clean product.
Right.
Low lead paint or something.
In a place where maybe by our next meeting we can all give some thought is that exact definition of what is a product that prevents, monitors, controls, or reduces? And are we going to talk about it's the utilization of that product and the process of the utilization of that process that creates the environmental benefit? To go to the Valero exemption. I'm not making a case one way or the other. I'm just saying that could be a ground for conversation. Is it? Because Ben and I think, and Don have both identified that their position being that there's a product there, and it's the utilization of that product that's creating the environmental benefit. Right? Is that fair?
Right. Yeah.
And that terminology
could be a starting place for putting more definition on what this means and what does it mean to utilize the product.
Having to make clean, you know, we obviously feel it would be problematic, not what everyone envisioned, and overly expansive if we make the production of environmentally compliant products tax exempt. If Priuses, the making of a Prius becomes tax exempt, the property used to create a Prius versus a pickup truck. Right?
Yeah.
It becomes a problem because we live in a society that tends to regulate on an environmental basis just about all products these days.
Okay, good discussion.
So should we all write a suggestion on the wording and pass it around? And
you're certainly to submit written comments, but I think a lot of us have something to chew on to talk about at the next meeting. And again, the ECL, I think, is the timeline that's the most urgent, right?
They're all with equal amounts of urgency.
It's all rulemaking.
Okay. It's all wrapped up in this rulemaking.
Would you, briefs, Cyrus Reed, the briefs, are those available through, how can we get a copy of the what was filed and what the TCQ filed and what Valero filed on this issue? Are those available?
It's probably on the website, right?
Is it?
I'm not sure if they're still posted. I know at one time they were posted on the website. Okay. Thanks.
Are those websites that have the top
websites?
Oh, okay. Thanks a lot.
Good. In the meantime, maybe it would be helpful to be given some specific context around the request on on-site issue. In other words, where does it appear in the rules? Was it just in the flow chart? Get us the flow chart. Because it
download rules. And until 2000, would y'all say one? When you actually put it in there, it was only in the flow chart.
Is it in the rule now? We put it in the rules.
It was in the rules.
And then I would invite, you know,
I'm sorry, I look around the table.
And I see a number of us that were in that advisory committee that did that rule. That did the rule back in 2001. And, you know, you and I were both there, and I can't remember why we did it. But I know there were some TCEQ staff that I see in the room that were there also, and I would invite them to remind us.
Is it in the rule?
Not to mention anyone particularly, Ron.
The only place at the site appears is on the flowchart.
Right. Yeah. Well, no, it didn't not appear after you redid the rules?
No, it's...
That's when it was added to the flow chart.
It was added to the flow chart in 2002. That's only stayed right on the flow chart.
I don't remember exactly everything why, but I bet there's some folks here at TCEQ that remember because they've been living with it and making it work. I'd love to be.
And I think it is a good thing to consider, Mike Massey, to get away from the on-off site concept because it's actually created some difficulties for some staff and some situations that seem artificial. Like regarding monitoring,